All right, so it's really great to be here. First time in Santa Barbara, first time on this part of the United States. And I really, really enjoyed the earlier talks and discussions today. I thought they were great. So as we just said, my name is David. I'm a postdoc at the Biodiversity Research Center in at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. And there I work for Patrick Keeling. So he's a protistologist and an evolutionary biologist, but he's really into the origin and the spread of chloroplasts across the tree of life. So it's been a really fun place to spend the last 2 years. So let me tell you a little bit about what I research and we'll be talking to you about today. So I study genome architecture. So in a really general sense, I'm interested in the evolutionary forces that shape genome structure, including genome conformation, chromosome number, telomeres, the evolution of genome size, so compact versus big bloated genomes, as well as genome content. So is the genome intron rich or intron poor? Is it full of repeats or very compact? Is it AT rich or GC rich? Now, I'm especially interested in how things like population dynamics, mutation rate, cell structure, and major evolutionary transitions, how all these things impact and shape genomes. Now, I'm particularly inspired as well by the belief that non-adaptive processes like random genetic drift and gene conversion have a major role in shaping genome architecture. So to study these issues, I use a lot of organelle genomes. So those are the genomes found inside the mitochondrion and chloroplasts of eukaryotic cells. So if I say to you guys, I say organelle genomes, a lot of you probably say, oh yeah, that's excellent for genetic barcoding, for phylogenetic analyses, for studying human migration, like we just saw in the previous presentation in the first slide. But many people forget that, in fact, a large part of our appreciation for genome architectural diversity across the tree of life is founded on organelle genetics, largely. And in fact, many of the leading hypotheses for how genomes evolve are based largely on some good organelle genome data. One that immediately comes to mind would be something like constructive neutral evolution, which was largely built back on some early observations of mitochondrial DNA. So over the last decade, I've been sequencing the organelle genomes from species all across the eukaryotic tree, so from things like AP complexum parasites to jellyfish to haptophyte algae, you name it. But today, I'm going to tell you about one particular area of my research, one of my favorite areas, and that's my work on green algal organelle genomes. Okay, so let's focus in on this part of the tree. We've heard a lot about green algae today, but it's always good to just quickly figure out what we're talking about here. So this is a tree of the green lineage. Up here in the upper left, you have vascular plants, and then down low, you got the charophyte green algae, so those green algae that are most closely related to land plants, so things like mesostigma, the unicellular, and chara. And then on the right-hand side, you have the chlorophyta, so that phylum that contains most of the known green algal diversity. And you can break that down into four classes. So you have the paraphyletic prosinophytes, some of the tiniest and most abundant eukaryotes in the world. Moving up, you have ovophytes, which are poorly studied, generally speaking. The trabuxiophytes, some of these are non-photosynthetic and even parasitic. And then finally, the chlorophyceans, a monophyletic clade of mostly freshwater flagellates and arguably the best studied group of green algae in the world. So I'm going to be talking to you today about the organelle genomes within this clade. And it's from a lineage called the Volvocales, which we've heard a lot about today already. So this is a tree of various Volvocales species for which we have organelle genome data. So let me just kind of present to you a few of the characters I'm going to be talking about today, okay? So up top here, you have my all-time favorite lineage. That's the Polytomela lineage. So they're freshwater unicells, but they're non-photosynthetic. So they no longer photosynthesize. And as you can see here, this is an EM of a Polytomela species, and it still has plastids, and they're plumb full of starch. So some Polytomela species, like P. magna, have an eye spot, and the pigments of which give it this beautiful pink color when you pellet it. Others have lost their eye spots, and they're kind of a dull white when you pellet them. Moving down, you have the Volvocene lineage, obviously, and we have kind of stars like the Chlamydomonas reinhardi, who's unicellular, and then ultimately Volvox carteri, which I think is the Brad Pitt of green algae. It's very beautiful. Moving down lower, you get to the Loboclamis group. And so these things, they look just like Chlamydomonas. They're unicellular flagellates, except they have in their sexual cycle, they're oogamous, so they produce dimorphic gametes, unlike Chlamydomonas, which is isogamous. And then last but not least, you have Denaliella, a unicellular, and it lives in an extremely salty water. It's plumb full of lipids, making it a prime candidate for biofuel production. All right, so when we look across this small tree, we see lots of interesting transitions from the loss of photosynthesis, loss of an eye spot, and we have some major transitions here that we know all about. Asexual, sexual isogamous, oogamous, movement to extreme habitats. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to go through this tree, and I'm going to highlight some of these really cool organelle genomes that I've been studying and my collaborators and I. And then in the back end, I'm going to tie in some of these organelle genome data into some ideas about how evolutionary transitions may be impacting the organelle genome architecture. Okay, so let's start with mitochondrial DNA conformation. So when I say something like that to you guys, I think a lot of you are thinking circles, right? You got some circles out there? Okay, so sure enough, some Volvocalian species have circular mitochondrial DNA, including Denaliella, Volvox, Pleurorhina, Gonium. But the group is exceptional in that many species have evolved linear and even linear fragmented mitochondrial genomes, where the genes can be distributed on two and even multiple chromosomes. Now, as you can see, it looks as though a linear mitochondrial DNA conformation in a fragmented one has evolved multiple times within this group. Now, these are true linear molecules in that they assemble as linear genomes, and they migrate on agarose gels as linear molecules as well. And they've even evolved complex terminal structures at their end called telomeres. So let me give you an example. So in all Polytomela species, you find single-stranded closed loops at their telomeres that are approximately 200 nucleotides in length, which is pretty funky. When you look across the tree of life, you find that other lineages, for example, some viruses with linear DNA chromosomes and some bacteria that even have linear chromosomes have evolved similar telomeric structures. Even other mitochondrial genomes outside of the green lineage that are linear have similar telomeres. Now, mitochondria, unlike nuclear systems, they don't have telomerase. So these peculiar structures at the ends of their molecule are thought to help the linear genome overcome the end replication problem that all linear genomes have to overcome. Now, when we look across the Volvocales, you can see a diversity of telomere structures. They're not all like this. For example, in Chlamydomonas, the ends of the mitochondrial chromosome are comprised of single-stranded 3' overhangs that are about 50 nucleotides in length. So it makes the group actually a model for not only studying a diversity of questions, but one including the evolution of telomeres. Okay, so we talked a little bit about mitochondrial DNA conformation. Let's change gears and talk for a few moments just about the nucleotide landscape within these mitochondrial genomes, with a bit of focus on Polytomela and these Loboclamis species. All right, so this is a plot of completely sequenced mitochondrial DNAs across all eukaryotes, okay, all of them. So you got about 2,700 of them. And they're arranged in ascending order based on their guanine and cytosine content. So as you can see, almost all mitochondrial DNAs are AT-rich. They have a GC content well below 50%, including most from the Volvocales. Now, when we explored the mitochondrial DNAs of Polytomela and Loboclamis species, we found something very interesting. Their mitochondrial genomes have a very, very high, for mitochondrial DNA, they had a very high GC content. In fact, these were the most GC-rich organelle genomes that had ever been observed. Now, when we look at the actual sequences of these mitochondrial genomes, these GC-rich ones, we find that the GC content is highest at intergenic regions and the synonymous sites of protein coding loci, so more neutral sites. But they're also, the GC content is also jacked up at hotspots in the genome that undergo recombination and gene conversion. So we can identify these tracks that are definitely undergoing gene conversion, because you can see homogenization amongst the different loci. And they have this very, very high GC content. So what we believe is that there's a GC-biased gene conversion process going on in these species. Now, after identifying these genomes, I wanted to find another GC-rich organelle genome to compare it to. So I went to GenBank, and I looked at all the next-gen sequencing data that was stored in there. And then I pulled out all the reads that I could find that corresponded to organelle genomes, and I searched all those for GC-rich organelle DNA. And I was able to identify a seedless vascular plant called Selaginella and assemble a large part of its mitochondrial genome. And it turns out that its GC content is off the mark. It's 70%. Now, I'll save this story for another day, but I will say just in passing that if you look at the mitochondrial DNA of this species, sure enough, you find lots of G's and C's, which is what you'd expect. And then if you map RNA-seq data onto this genome, you find that a lot of those G's and C's are converted to uracil through RNA editing, okay? So this isn't uncommon for land plant mitochondrial genomes. In fact, a lot of them have this C to U RNA editing. But in Selaginella, it's unprecedentedly high. So you see massive, massive amounts of this C to U RNA editing. And then if you account for all this editing, because it's going on in all the different regions, including the non-coding regions, because many of them get transcribed, it actually is AT-rich. So it's, in fact, a GC-rich mitochondrial genome that's disguised as an AT-rich one, which is kind of funky. There's no RNA editing going on in any of these guys. So hold on, it's just taking a while to transition here. Okay, so I won't say too much about the mitochondrial DNA gene content across these species, except that it's essentially the same. So they all encode basically the same number and types of mitochondrial genes. But in Polytunnel Magna, we're finding a very peculiar gene architecture. So if you zoom into its linear mitochondrial genome and then focus in on the coding regions, you find something like this. So every single gene in its mitochondrial genome is duplicated, and it's arranged in a palindromic unit, including the protein coding regions, the ribosomal RNA coding regions, and the tRNA coding genes. So this is an example of just three of those loci. Now, what's even neater is that if you take those palindromic gene units and you fold them into stem loop structures, you find something like this. So the start codon for the protein coding loci is found in the short loop portion of that stem loop, and the stop codon for the gene is found in the intervening sequence between the palindromic gene units, which also means that there's only essentially one functional gene per palindromic gene unit. So I've looked across all organelle genomes, and in fact, most genomes from bacteria and eukaryotes, and I can't find another situation where every gene is arranged in this really cool palindromic architecture. So we think this is pretty unique for Polytunnella. Now, if you take this mitochondrial genome and you run it on a pulse field gel, and then blot that gel with mitochondrial DNA probes, you find, sure enough, a band that corresponds to the mitochondrial DNA at its predicted size. But you also find bands hybridizing to mitochondrial DNA at high molecular weight. Okay? And so we think these are actually the mitochondrial genome forming these stem loop structures that I just showed to you, and that's hindering the migration of this molecule in these gels. So which is kind of... Okay, so let's quickly change gears and talk for just a brief moment about chloroplast genomes. Okay, so I'll say just in passing that we've done complete nuclear transcriptome sequencing of Polytomela parva through the Betty Moore Foundation and the National Center for Genome Research. And we've also done massive amounts of next-gen for all three of these species, next-gen DNA sequencing. And so we can find absolutely no indications of a plastid gene expression system or any of the indications of plastid DNA at all in any of these taxa. So it looks like they've actually lost their plastid genome. If this were true, as it seems to be, this would be the very, very first example of a species with a primary plastid that has actually lost its plastid genome. So that would be very, very interesting. Now, the opposite is going on in these taxa. Their chloroplast genomes have become massive. So let me show you what I'm talking about. So this is a plot of completely sequenced chloroplast genomes from all across the tree of life. You have chloroplast genome size in kilobases down here, and you have the amount of non-coding DNA in that chloroplast genome on the y-axis. So as you can see, most chloroplast genomes are around 100 to 200 kilobases, and they have less than 50% non-coding DNA. Now, it's something like Volvox, which many of you are interested in. You find a gigantic plastid genome. So at 500,000 nucleotides and greater than 80% non-coding DNA, Volvox has the most inflated chloroplast genome ever observed. And so do other Volvocalian algae. They're quite large. So Pleurotoria, Denaliella, Gonium, Chlamydomonas. This point up here that's close to Volvox, that belongs to Floridiella terrestris. So that's a green alga that's within the Chlorophyceae, but it's found in a clade outside of the Volvocales. So another way to look at some of these data is to focus in on the Volvocene line. So this is just highlighting some of those species in the Volvocene line. If I add the chloroplast genome architecture data to this plot, you see something like this. So these are plastid genomes, their size in kilobases up top here, and the fraction of non-coding nucleotides in those chloroplast genomes is shown in dark here. And so as you can see, as you move across the Volvocene lineage, and cell number goes up, and as some would say, complexity goes up, you can see that the size of the plastid genomes and the amount of non-coding DNA in those plastid genomes also goes up. Now, the mitochondrial genomes of these taxa, they're much smaller than their plastid counterparts. But when you add that data to this tree, you find a similar trend. So mitochondrial DNA size and the amount of non-coding DNA in those mitochondrial genomes, they also scale with cell number within the Volvocene lineage. Other types of organelle genome embellishments, like repeats and intron number, they also scale like this. So this here, which is going to pop up in 1 second, the file is probably way too big. Let's come on. This, what you're going to see in a moment, I'm just building up suspense, yep, is a dot plot of the Chlamydomonas, mitochondrial, and plastid genomes. So all you need to know is that a dot in this matrix corresponds to a repeat element in that organelle genome. So as you can see, the Chlamydomonas mitochondrial genome has hardly any repeats. There's hardly any dots in this matrix, whereas the plastid genome is full of repeats. And then if we look at dot plots for those other Volvocene species on that tree, we can see that the amount of repeat elements within those organelle genomes goes up incrementally as you move along the Volvocene lineage, eventually ballooning in Volvox, where we see massive amounts of repeats. So the question that I want to talk about for a few moments is how do we explain this? Why do we find that something like Volvox has a massive amount of non-coding DNA in its organelle genomes, much, much more than something like Chlamydomonas and other plastid-bearing eukaryotes? So there's lots of different hypotheses to explain the evolution of genome size. So the one I want to talk about today is called the mutational hazard hypothesis, which was put forward by Mike Lynch, who's here today. So it argues that essentially the amount of non-coding DNA in a genome is going to be driven by the effective population size and the mutation rate. So in this expression, the mutation rate defines the burden of carrying excess DNA. So the greater your mutation rate, the greater a burden it is to carry excess DNA, like introns, repeats, and DNA in general. And then the effective population size defines the ability of natural selection in some ways to detect and eradicate that burden. So in a simple way, the hypothesis predicts that species with a large NEMU or a high NEMU will have more compact genomes than those with a small NEMU. I'll say that one more time. So the hypothesis predicts that species with a large NEMU will have more compact genomes. So it can be quite difficult to estimate these parameters, but you can gain insights into them by measuring the nucleotide diversity at silent sites, so non-coding and synonymous positions within a species or a population, right? With slight modification to this depending on the ploidy and the mode of inheritance. So large-scale analyses have explored the relationship between the silent site diversity within a genome and its architecture with data sets that include bacterial genomes, the nuclear genomes of eukaryotes, and even organelle genomes. So let me just show you some of the data on organelle DNA. So on this very dumbed-down plot, you have genome architecture on the left-hand side. So it's just very straightforward. If it's white, it's going to be a very compact genome. And if it's blue, it's going to be a very bloated genome. And then on this axis, you have the silent site genetic diversity within that genome that's been measured. So we essentially know very, very little about silent site diversity within organelle genomes. And generally speaking, we know very little about it when we leave model species for any genome. So the best data for mitochondrial and plastid DNA come from land plants and animals and to a certain degree fungi. So when you look at means within groups, you kind of get this general trend coming through. And that's that land plant mitochondrial DNA, which is renowned for being very, very bloated, so being mostly non-coding, tends to have, with some exceptions, very, very low silent site genetic diversity. In fact, it harbors some of the lowest levels of genetic diversity observed in any genome. At the opposite end of this spectrum, you have animal mitochondrial genomes, which many of you have probably worked with for various reasons. And we know they're tiny, they're you know, usually around 16 kilobases and hardly any non-coding DNA. And they harbor huge amounts of silent site diversity. Now it's thought that this massive difference in the amount of diversity these two genomes harbor is largely a reflection of huge differences in their mutation rates, with mitochondrial DNA having a massive mutation rate and land plant mitochondrial genomes having a very low mutation rate. And the chloroplast genomes of land plants falling kind of in the middle in terms of diversity and their bloatedness. Yeah, per nucleotide. Not per whole genome. The mutation rate per nucleotide site per, yep. So again, and I know this is the end of a long day, and I don't want to throw lots of complex stuff at you, but this supports, to a certain degree, the hypothesis that I put forward a few minutes ago. So a lot of my work as a protistologist has focused on measuring nucleotide diversity within nuclear and organelle genomes of diverse eukaryotes. So things like AP complexins, heterokon algae, haptophyte algae, I'm all over the bloody tree. Okay, so let me show you some of this, including, so I what much of this has been focusing on volvocalian green algae. So these are just to show you an example of some of the things we've been doing. So for example, for Volvox carteri, we brought in strains and isolates from India and Japan, and we sequenced large portions of their organelle genomes, if not complete, and lots of nuclear loci. And then the same for Denaliella, isolates from Norway and Australia. For Chlamydomonas, we explore diversity amongst isolates all across the eastern U.S. And in the for something like Polytomela, we looked at isolates across the U.K. and the Czech Republic. So I know this looks like small-scale stuff when you talk to people who study model species. And they have, you know, thousands of isolates all across. But for protists, this is the beginning. It's like, you know, it's the frontier. So we're just starting to gather this type of data for some of these weird eukaryotes. So one of the things that is coming through is the fact is when you look at some of these species like Volvox and Denaliella, whose mitochondrial and plastid genomes are very full of non-coding DNA and are very intron-rich, we're finding that they have very, very low levels of diversity. Even when you're comparing an isolate from India to that of Japan, you're having a hard time identifying any polymorphisms within the chloroplast genome. Okay, it's not like that for the nucleus. So when we look at the nuclear DNA, the diversity is much higher. So going back to this plot, this simple plot again about silent site diversity and genome architecture, if we were to put Volvox on here, we'd find that, again, its plastid and mitochondrial DNAs are very inflated like those of land plants, and they in fact have very, very low levels of silent site diversity as they find in most land plants with many exceptions. And something like Chlamydomonas, much higher levels of silent site diversity in their organelle compartments. And same with Polytomela. Conversely, Denaliella falls here, and then just a few of these other green algae that I've been looking at. So again, a gross oversimplification, but I just want you to kind of be able to remember this slide in days to come and weeks to come, so it sticks in your mind that we're finding a general negative scaling between diversity and genome compactness. Now, if you want the nitty-gritty story with all the numbers and the error bars, I'd be happy to kind of go over this in lots of detail with you in the days to come. Now, then zooming back in, just to kind of wind this home, when we go back to this Volvocene lineage, we're seeing that in its organelle genomes, the silent site diversity goes up as we move back down towards Chlamydomonas. Now, this trend of genome expansion along this line is not just restricted to the organelle DNAs. For example, if you look at the mating loci, so these are loci found within the nuclear genome that determine the sex or the mating type of these algae, you find as well that the size of the mating locus goes up as you move along, as does the amount of non-coding DNA harbored in that locus. And again, we're just starting to explore diversity within the locus, within mating types, and we're finding that it too, you have very, very low levels when you're looking within females or within males within the mating locus, much higher than when you're looking within, much lower, I mean, than when you're looking in something like Chlamydomonas reinhardi, which again supports this view that any mu may be impacting genome architecture. So I realize I'm not on the forefront of studying the types of questions you're studying in terms of multicellularity. I'm a genome geek and a protostologist. But I thought that kind of showing you what other people are doing and exploring in terms of how, so I too am interested in how these transitions in individuality are impacting the genome architecture. But not from the point of I think some of you may approach it from the point where you're looking for a particular gene or the levels of transcription or methylation and how that's causing an adaptation that could lead to changes in individuality and multicellularity. I'm approaching it from maybe the other end, where how do these changes, once they've occurred or as they're slowly occurring, how does that cause non-adaptive changes to the genome architecture? Now, just to kind of take it one final step home here, this was a big image. So this is my very final slide here, once it pops up. So okay, so I hope, if anything, that the next time you think of this group, you look at the Volvocales, you say, wow, they got amazing organelle genomes. right? They're not only they're circular, but we've seen the linear molecules arise, telomeres, fragmented chromosomes, GC enrichment, genome inflation, you name it, and the list goes on. So I didn't put up references for any of those, the data that I put forward. I just decided to put kind of a list at the end here of the different species we've been exploring. And these are some of the many people who've helped with the green algal organelle genome analyses. And finally, there will be a conference, I'll go back to the other slide in a moment, on Volvox this coming August in New Brunswick. So I'll just leave that up there as well.
Thank you very much, David. If I must, may just start with the first question, Matt, before I come to you. So just to get that scaling right, there's a negative scaling between genome diversity and size. Between size and...
Yeah, we find that, many people have explored this, and it's finding that genomes that harbor a large amount of silent site diversity,
right.
So lots of polymorphisms, tend, although this is controversial and many people will disagree, but in some studies it shows they tend to have more compact genome, less non-coding DNA.
Oh,
so okay. In that Volvox, which has the mass of plastid genome, incredibly low levels of silent site diversity,
right.
which may reflect either a very low mutation rate or a low effective population size.
Okay.
How dependent do you think your nucleotide diversity estimates are to accurate species boundaries?
Well, for the case of Volvox, when we compared the strain from India to the strains from Japan,
yeah.
We knew that they'd done crosses with them, and they'd shown that in fact only 10% of the progeny survive or are viable. So it's already showing that they're in fact almost different species, but it's still...
Well, I'm thinking on the other end, actually.
It's still
talking about your two Chlamydomonas. When you're looking within Chlamydomonas, how confident...
We only use strains that have been shown to cross.
Okay.
Yeah.
I can go? Okay. Hi. Sorry.
Oh, sorry. Yeah,
that's okay. Thanks. Just for clarification, your tree of the Volvocales that came up over and over again, it wasn't rooted. Where's the root?
The root would be just the next species out. I just took that from basic.
Okay, so Denaliella is sister to everybody else.
Denaliella is sister, and then going back, you got Skinodesmus, and yeah. Yeah, sir.
So the interesting fragmentation and prototelomeres that you saw in the chloroplasts, you're confident from phylogenetic studies that wasn't inherited from some ancestral bacteria? That
I think they're almost 100% sure now that, mm-hmm. The only problem is that when you define a circular genome, it means it assembles as a circular molecule, and in most cases it migrates on a gel as a circular molecule. Right, so that's what we're talking about when we talk about circles. But some people have argued that they're never really circular, that they're always derived from these complex structures that you don't see in the gel because they just stay in the well. But they're sure that I think the original mitochondrial genome was circular.
Okay, yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Volvox and Danieliella? The question is so there's editing,
but
I guess. The question is, has it been the degree of editing been worked out in these two genomes? Because the prediction would be that they'd have a higher level of editing when NEU's lower.
Exactly, yeah.
Thank you. Any more questions? Guy?
I wonder if you can say something about the connection between increased complexity and non-coding RNA. It seems that there is some hints for connections in your data.
The increase in complexity mm-hmm. in an organism or in a genome?
Yeah, no, in the organism.
In an organism and the non-coding RNA.
Yeah.
And this is obviously now we've moved over to the nuclear genome. I wouldn't be able to comment too much.
It seems that you're seeing that in the Volvox that there is an increased percentage of non-coding DNA, I think, isn't it?
In Volvox, there is more non-coding DNA in all of its compartments, the mitochondrial, the chloroplast, and the nuclear genome, relative to many other green algae.
Yeah. And do you think that it's related also to non-coding RNA that are associated with complexity and gene regulation and so forth?
No, I wouldn't necessarily. I'd have to think hard about that. I'd have to sit down with a glass of wine and think. Yeah.
Thank you. Thanks. Any more questions? No, that's it. Okay, well, thank you very much, David.
Thank you.
And thank you to the young who spoke today, and we shall meet here again tomorrow morning at 9:00.